bring you up to speed on many critical issues that are just not talked about anywhere else. We try to make this a smorgasbord, a banquet, as it were, of critical information for you to take and use it as you will, help you make better decisions. You there, young lady?
I am here, Jeff.
You sound younger than you did the last time. All right. Now, what I'd like to start out with is something that really stunned me when I found out about it. We've talked about it, but not enough. And I think this is really critical. First of all, tell us what that doctor was finding out in terms of, we're going to talk about cancer a lot this hour, turbo cancers. What did that doctor find? And he's talking about, I guess, one 12-hour shift, two 12-hour shifts, something.
Yeah, that's right. He posted on his Twitter account that he was working in an urgent care stint, a 12-hour shift, and I believe he said he saw two cases of pancreatic cancer, but this is typical for every 12-hour shift that he works.
That's
and the common denominator is that most of these, well, I'd say all of these people, are probably on their fourth shot, second booster, of this injection.
Right. All right. Now, cancer doesn't usually hurt until it gets to a pretty substantial state of affairs. Then you can notice it. You'll notice a lump, of course. That's always there. And if it involves the nerves, it can cause nerve pain. But cancer is usually kind of a stealthy thing in the beginning. But what this bioweapon does, and I have to think it was built in and designed as part of this package of death, it turns off the body's ability to, it's like a burglar alarm, all right? Pathogenicity comes into the body like a thief. And what's it stealing? Your health. Pathogens steal your health. We have a burglar alarm system in our body. It's called symptoms. Symptomology. Got it? You have symptoms, and they let you know to be concerned about something, or just to let you know that you're dealing with something. But what if that symptomology was turned off, and you had no more warning, you had no more burglar alarm, and so the pathogens coming into your body to steal your health and ultimately your life are no longer visible, or you're not hearing about it? This is a big deal. Now, the fact of the matter is, these injections, these bioweapon injections, were designed to shut down your body's burglar alarm, your symptoms, the symptomology of poor health or threatening issues to your body. You no longer have symptoms. Now, that may sound bizarre, but you better listen carefully, because it's true. And to a very large degree, the vaxxed no longer have the symptomology or burglar alarm to warn about pathogen thieves in their bodies trying to steal their health. Tell us a little bit more about how that works. You've got it down.
Well, the SARS-CoV-2 virus does this to some extent. It turns off the interferon response, which is one of the first lines of protection. That's, you know, a sensor in the cell that alerts the cell that something foreign is trying to come in, some kind of nucleic acid. I mean, virus is a cellular parasite composed of foreign nucleic acids, either RNA or DNA, and it wants to use the machinery of this cell to reproduce itself. So the cell has mechanisms to detect this, and the appropriate response initially is to generate something called interferon, type 1 interferon. And then in some cases, some viruses have evolved a way to turn that off. And this SARS-CoV-2 one does it in spades. Coincidentally, part of the transfection of these injections does the same thing, probably even more so. So when it turns off the interferon response and the body's ability to generate inflammation and fever and things that are designed to slow you down and divert energy into dealing with what's coming in, trying to take over, you really don't have much in the way of symptoms. And that would apply for anything that's needing, I guess, some kind of a reaction, you know, to prevent it from invading.
Right. Right.
And all the way down to a cancer cell. Cancer cells, a fever is really beneficial in that one of the consequences of a fever, it will put enough pressure or stress on cells that are not quite functioning up to snuff and weed them out. And this is part of your innate immune response as opposed to your adaptive immune response. Innate is just a very broad-based defense mechanism to keep things out that shouldn't be in. And as I said, this virus disables a part of it, and the bioweapon injection does it in multiple ways, not just the interferon response, but also the toll-like receptors. What else? I'm drawing a blank.
The point is our burglar alarm system is being shut off, okay?
Yeah.
And the secondary worry I have is that shedding may lead to the same thing in the unvaxxed. It may begin to diminish your interferon function and other functions, which would otherwise warn you that something's wrong. Now, a lot of these people who have been vaxxed have no symptoms, and they walk into a doctor, and the doctor does some tests, and say, I'm not quite right here, a little bit there, but minimal. But they're nagging, and they go in. And they're told, you have stage 4 liver cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, kidney cancer, brain cancer, glioblastoma, whatever. And these people hadn't a clue. And it's part and parcel of the shutting off of the symptomology that your body relies upon to be aware that it's being invaded. This is really damning. And I believe that this was factored into the composition of this bioweapon. This thing is so damn diverse, and we've said it for well over 2 years now. It's astounding the many ways it has that are anti-life to take you out. It's just incredible.
The transfection process itself is immune suppressive. It's no different than transplanting somebody else's organ into a body, foreign organ into a body. You're trying to convince your body to produce copious amounts of a foreign protein that it does not want to do. So there's ways of turning off components of the immune system that you know would normally react to this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be long-lasting in the case of this injection. And it isn't just disabling one or two pathways. The protein itself, once it's produced, continues the job in crippling other parts of the immune system. The DNA repair pathways, for one.
It's such a bad thing. People don't understand. It's unprecedented, and it's evil. Okay.
Yeah, it is.
We have our friend and your friend, Nurse Ann, back on tonight. Nurse Ann has been with us for a long time. She is a career, highly skilled professional in the field of nursing. She's working in a major New York hospital. She's been working, I guess, in a couple of them. And she's seeing things there that are absolutely appalling. If you want to know what's really happening, Nurse Ann is the one that you'd want to hear. And she's back with us tonight. Welcome back.
Hello, Jeff and Erica.
Hi, Ian.
How are you doing? Okay.
I'm doing good.
All right. Good. You've had a couple of encounters with unpleasant health stages as they come and go. And you're okay, though, now. You're back up on top of your game.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, right. I am. I'm doing pretty good. I'm just a little fatigued. But other than that, that's due to a lot doing four nights a week now at this hospital, 12-hour shift. So it gets a little bit tiring.
I don't
bet.
Know how you do it. The psycho-emotional damage of that, or strain, would be incalculable. I couldn't do it. There's no way. I don't know how you do. But you're one in a million, so you're making a difference. All right. The story about the doctor working 12-hour shifts and finding two cases per shift of pancreatic cancer probably won't surprise you, but it comes as a surprise to a lot of people. And that's not uncommon. What are you seeing in the general hospital environment now vis-a-vis cancers? What's going on?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with the finding. We're finding that they're having the cancer diagnosis come up after they present with something else first. And our typical, there's been a lot of admissions regarding people who are having major strokes, and I seriously mean it, major strokes. There's a lot of damage to patients when we see them.
Yeah. And give me a very simple profile, quick profile on people who come in, age, sex, disposition, physiology, who have major strokes. Who are these people?
Yeah.
Older people, younger people, across the board. What do we got?
No, I had a 29-year-old person who had a major stroke all the way up to the 80s having major strokes. And the 29-year-old is coming in. It was basically collapsed on his floor at home. The 80-year-old people the initial EMS call is they had fallen, and usually they're fallen because they've had a huge stroke, and that's what's bringing them in. And then when we get the workup, a lot of serious damage is done to the brain tissue, and they're treating them, if they can get them in the window, to treat for the TPA, which is the clot-busting medication. It's the only one that they can use when they hit the emergency room doors. If they hit that window, which they have like 6-hour window to get that medication in, assuming they're found on time. The 29-year-old was not found on time.
Really?
Now this is an anti... I'm sorry, Erica, go ahead. What?
So was he obviously alone when this happened, and then somebody discovered him later on, or...?
Yes. A family member had gone to check on him in the morning, and this was the kicker. He had he'd been presenting with right-sided weakness, and his words were slurred at the time. And the family left. The family left and then came back a few hours later because he hadn't answered his phone, and they found him on the floor. Now they're calling EMS. And so it was really, really too late for him. He ended up cardiac arresting, by the way, in the ER. After having a stroke. And they did bring him back. They brought him back. And when they did his workup, they found out that he has a really bad heart. He has cardiomyopathy already.
Oh, my God.
He has apparently he had renal and he's been in acute renal failure. So they're indicating some sort of an infection was going on. And he had presented with complete right-sided weakness. He couldn't move his right side, not all. He wasn't able to communicate at all when he presented. And they had initially intubated him, and he was in the ICU. But he had a severe left middle cerebral artery stroke. And we're seeing a lot of them. We're seeing a lot of middle cerebral artery strokes coming in.
And can you tell us what that medicine is? What?
It's called TPA. It is TPA. A drug. Yeah, it's a drug that they give that actually will break up the clot.
If it's a blood based clot, what if it's an amyloid stroke?
Exactly. They're not looking for that. They're not looking for that part. That's the problem. I think, honestly, so many times they miss it because they're not looking for the type of clot that they should be looking for. Uh-huh. I've not yet to see any testing done to actually even show that they're doing any testing for amyloid clots in any way. I don't see any of that. They do a lot of testing. I'll give that to the hospital. They'll do all the appropriate testing, but they will not. They will not check for that particular type of clot. So, of course, if they can, if they have not had bleeding in the brain, because that comes with it, if they have not had bleeding in the brain, they will put them on the heparin, which they think is associated to a blood clot. They'll do all of the tests that they need to do. They'll do the CAT scans. They'll do the usually they'll do the Doppler studies for your arteries on your neck. And 9 times out of 10, by the way, there's blockage in the arteries in the neck, by the way.
Oh, God.
We're finding that now. Yeah, it's incredible. And
you mean Anne, excuse me, are you talking about just random tests? Anybody that they test, they're finding 9 times out of 10 that anyone who's tested for circulation, blood flow in the neck is compromised?
If they present like they're having either a transischemic attack or a stroke, they will work them up for a blockage in the arteries of the neck. Or if they're also having heart issues, they'll do that. They'll do it for that too. They're doing like MRIs testing. Every stroke victim, of course, is getting an MRI. This guy, he showed he had a positive stroke. They tried to treat him with the TPA, and then they ended up when they did the MRI, they actually saw that he had a hemorrhage in the brain already.
Oh.
And yeah, and then he also had over 50% stenosis, which is a narrowing or blockage of the bilateral carotids in the neck. At 29.
What would cause stenosis like that? The clamping. In other words, imagine, if you will, everyone, that you have a 1-inch diameter pipe, and all of a sudden that pipe is 1/2-inch diameter. It's shrunk down. What's causing the shrinkage in the diameter of the arteries in the neck? What's causing that? Is it from the inside, or is it from the outside pushing in on the artery?
Well, that's the thing, Jeff. Like, the physicians are left scratching their heads at this point. They've never seen such a sick population, and it's from the very young to the very old. And like, the young people are presenting like what the 80-year-old used to present with. The people who have lived a life probably had been smoking all their life, and had, you know, didn't follow a good diet or were inactive or whatever. But you shouldn't be seeing this kind of level of sickness in a 29-year-old. And then to top it all off, they did another test, which you know, checks the valves of the heart, and it's called TEE. And they found that he had a mass on his mitral valve, and he had endocarditis.
Oh, my gosh.
He had a mass on the mitral valve. That sounds like a tumor of sorts, maybe.
Maybe.
All right. Erica, you know what this sounds like? It goes back to our discussions about how people age and they look 10 years older all of a sudden.
Yes.
And now I'm wondering if maybe they not only look 10 years older, but maybe their entire biophysiology is aging at the same rate that their diminished appearance is showing aging.
Yeah, well, general appearance is a pretty good indicator of, you know, how somebody's doing physiologically. And this is a disease of accelerated aging. There's no question. It's severe oxidative stress. It's microclotting. You know, the cycles of ischemia reperfusion from microclotting, and which affects every organ and tissue. And you know, you get enough of that over time, you're going to get calcification in the blood vessels. Some will get stretched out, others will harden. And everything, every organ and tissue suffers. And you know, whatever you had going on prior to this injection, this assault, will probably be the thing that goes first, which is why, you know, we're probably getting a lot of different presentations following these injections.
But the point is, these people may be literally aging inside and out at an incredibly accelerated rate after these shots.
Well, that's exactly like radiation. I mean, that's the first autopsies that they were allowed to do on the victims of this bioweapon, the virus at the time. The pathologists thought that they had been poisoned by radiation. That's how severe the inflammation and oxidative stress was.
Wow. All right. Anne, go ahead, please. So this young man, in addition to this litany of horrors, had a growth on his mitral valve, which suggests potential cancer. So there you go.
Right. And then they, when they did the ejection fraction, just to see how well his heart was pumping, you know, how well his ejection fraction was 30 to 35%, which is extremely low for such a young person. I've never seen a young person being so sick with so many, what I would have viewed as, going back in my earlier career, I would have said this would have been a situation where you would see a very much an older person presenting with all of these problems. And
what did his chart show about shots?
He was fully vaxxed and boosted.
Boosted. So he had probably five, six shots. Unbelievable.
He had a total of four? In his chart. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And then,
just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we were all saying it. I mean, the doctors were left scratching. They consulted multiple specialties. They had vascular on the case. They had neuro on the case. They had neurosurgery on the case. They had to get GI in on the case because they found out when they had an EGD done, they found he had three large esophageal ulcers, but with no active bleeding, which it was a shocking thing because, you know, he had been given TPA as well, you know, so we could have actually caused yet another problem in the midst of treating him.
All right. Okay. This is these things are common. We're discussing one case. These are happening all over the country, all over the world in many ways. So
Can I ask one thing?
Go.
I'm just wondering, do you have any history on him prior to his showing up in the ER?
Other than he had been diagnosed with paroxysmal AFib, and he was on Eliquis for that.
All right, so this is not
the only... No, this was the only kind of history that I had on him at the time, because he was very young. He hadn't ever admitted to the system before. It was the first time we had been seeing him.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Did he have any sort of history of heart issues or anything else? And this was just something that was getting worse.
Yeah,
but
He didn't even have like any issues with high blood pressure, which would have brought on possibly the stroke, possibly the issues with the kidneys or the heart. He didn't have that. He wasn't a diabetic either. So it didn't make any, like this, we've never seen anything like this. Is it? He was definitely probably one of the sickest patients we've seen over the past 3 weeks.
And yet before he fell and was found, he was probably reasonably functional before he had the big stroke. He was sick as hell, but still functional. And that's why I talk about people all the time. You can't tell by looking many times. They look normal. They're not. So let's shift on. If you're done with that one, so he had three shots and a booster, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Four in total.
Right. So how about the cancer aspect of it? What are you seeing there? Turbo cancers, whatever.
Yeah. We did have a patient then that he presented. This is a 74-year-old. And how he presented to us was he had been struggling to eat. He was losing weight. He'd been out in India traveling with his son, and apparently he had a stroke while he was over in India. So they treated him over in India, in Bangladesh, for the stroke. And then he ended up somehow recovering from that. And he was brought back to he came back to the U.S. because that's where he lives. When he got back here, he was to follow up with his physicians. So his physicians went ahead and they did a major workup because they had heard about the stroke and he to see what was going on. So they go to check. They do a CT of his head and his and an MRI, and it shows that he most definitely had a stroke. But after that, they started doing more testing, and they found he had pancreatic cancer, which he didn't know he had. And it wasn't found when he was in India. And then, so now he is brought into the hospital because he's not eating. And his family think it's because of the stroke. Not eating, he's losing weight. And they end up doing a resection on him. And then he ended up having a splenectomy on top of that. And then
they took his spleen out.
Mm-hmm. And then he ends up with a small bowel obstruction. And now he's getting duodenal stents placed because he's having more abdominal issues. And then finally, he couldn't eat anymore orally. He couldn't take anything in. So now he was put, he was given a tube down his nose to his stomach, which is a nasogastric tube, and he's getting feedings through that temporarily until they find out that they decide to put in an access port in his chest to allow them to give him food through the IV called a TPN. And that's how he was getting his nutrition. That's how he's been getting his nutrition for weeks.
And the suspicion I hear is that there may be other cancer issues as well.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's kind of all over the map. We had a patient that we couldn't treat. He actually had to go to a specialty facility, a cancer facility. And this guy was, he was only 70 years of age. And but they found a tumor, a huge tumor that when they were actually working him up for the CVA that he presented with. See, that's the thing. They're coming in for something different, and we're finding out they're actually having tumors. So he actually had presented with left-sided weakness and confusion, and then we come to find, and he had been having headaches for a number of weeks, according to the family. And then we come to find out when we do the workup, he has a huge brain tumor. And it's something that we can't seem to manage in our hospital. So they have actually transferred this particular patient to an actual cancer facility within the state.
I don't know how you go in there to work. That's grim stuff. Grim stuff. These people obviously they're at the end of the line. Their lives are pretty much, they're done.
You would think that, but I've met them, and it's funny. The cancer patients, two of these men were fabulous. They were talking to me, and they weren't acting unwell, but they knew they were really sick. And it was like the thing about it is the gentleman that I told you that has the brain tumor. He was able to get up and walk and talk to us, But as soon as they start to do any kind of surgery on him, it's going to be a game changer.
Sure.
But the tumor is rather involved, according to neural. So I met him when he was still himself. And the other gentleman that, unfortunately, he had the stroke in India, and then he comes over here and then he finds out he has even more to contend with. He's able to talk to it. He's got a very involved family. They have really appreciated the work that the nurses have given. But we're always working under huge amount of stress, always understaffed. Most of the hospital is actually staffed by travel nurses. I have no idea where the staff nurses went, but there's very few staff nurses within this hospital anymore. So I don't know where they went. But we have travel nurses assuming charge nurse roles, which you would never have seen at any other time. And now travel nurses are there to come in to assist and take patient assignments and take care of those number of patients. But there's a charge nurse who knows the unit intimately, the protocols, everything that people to contact, the physicians, the departments that we have to talk to for, getting patients to certain departments for like CTs and MRI scans and things like that. They're not there. We're assuming these roles. The other thing is the nurses are having too many patients. The ratios are too high. And the patients are really, really sick. So from the time I get on the unit till the time I clock out, I don't stop moving. My first week I lost five pounds just in my first week.
Well, you're not one to take breaks very often, I'm sure. This is really horrible. The obvious question is, how long can such an horrific situation continue? This hospital sounds like it's already disabled and it's still functioning. I mean, how long can you do this with travel nurses?
And that's the thing. The travel nurses are getting tired, too. When I signed up for this contract, I wasn't allowed to choose to have just work three nights a week. It was basically, it's four nights a week or nothing. And every nurse that's in this hospital, that's a travel nurse, is working four nights a week at this hospital. And now they're asking the travel nurses pick up overtime when they don't have enough staff to cover other units at the hospital.
Oh my.
It's insane.
Oh my.
I've been busy, but I've never been this busy. And I've never seen the population so sick.
Okay. That was my next question. The population coming into the hospital is what, at an all-time high? Where is it?
The ER is completely filled all the time. They're scrambling to fill beds, but then they have to worry about, can the staff handle it? Can the staff take on another patient based on the acuity of the patients? So it's extremely tough. If you notice, if you look at the job ads, they can't find ER nurses anymore. The ER nurses, it's incredible. The ER nurses are done. They're done. The ICU nurses are done. It's hard to find anyone now who's on staff.
Does this go back to, a year and a half ago when they tried to force all professional healthcare workers to take the injections and one-third of them walked? They refused. Two-thirds stayed on, took the shots, or thereabout, and one-third left. The hospital's never really recovered from that loss. That's been difficult. And since then, it sounds like what you're saying, the attrition rate is very high because of the stress and the fact that these nurses are travel nurses. They're not in their hometowns. They go out and I don't know how long the contract is for, 90 days, 60 days?
They usually do about 3 months, 90 days.
And then they get to go home to their families. Ha ha.
Yes.
I just, this is preposterous. And Is there any light at the end of the tunnel, or do you see this continuing just to spiral down, as it obviously is, with numbers of patients? The patient population, if the ER is full all the time, this takes a lot of effort for each patient.
Yeah, there's no downtime. It's not slowing down. The people are getting way, they're much sicker. I mean, we were dealing with a lot of issues pre-COVID, then COVID, and then thereafter. But we've never seen people coming in presenting with so many multiple issues in regards to organs. I mean, every organ is affected. And, like, there's no explanation for a 29-year-old to be this sick.
System breakdown. These patients are breaking down systemically, it sounds like.
I would agree. The other thing I didn't mention was you're seeing a lot of subdural hematomas is another one. That is in combination with the strokes and the falls. And I know I've been listening to Erica for a couple of weeks, and she's hearing the EMS reports, and it's always, initially it's the fall, but there's something else brings the fall on. And that's what people need to know, is that people aren't just dropping. They're dropping for a reason, you know?
Got it.
And then the other thing was, oh, my goodness, yes, the renal failure state is through the roof. So many people end up on dialysis. It's incredible. So if you're having any stent in the hospital where you have a long stay, I'm here to tell you, you're going to be getting dialysis by the time before you ever get out of there. You're going to have dialysis. It's incredible the amount of failure that we are seeing, partly due to whatever brought them into the hospital to begin with. Secondly, the amount of what the medications we're giving them is putting huge amounts of pressure and making the kidneys almost toxic to the point where they're going to end up in renal failure. They're going to end up getting dialysis. That's what's happening. And I was running through before I came on the show, I counted it. There was a patient who came in, one of the patients I discussed came in with four medications from home. That was it. She had four. She had 16 medications on her medication record by the time she was in the hospital within a day. She starts out with four, now she's got 16.
They added 12 in one day to her regimen.
12 in one day.
You mentioned the subdural hematomas. Now, these, you said, from falls and obviously potentially from strokes. Are these small? Are they big hematomas? Hematomas are when there's a brain bleed, okay, inside the skull for everyone. And it's can be the size of a quarter, a half a dollar. It can be tiny. It could be the size of a dime. And you think, tell me more about that. That's a big neurological development. You're seeing a lot of subdurals. Yeah. That's odd.
Yeah. So the one that I'm going to talk about, this patient is 64-year-old female, and she was already getting dialysis. She was already a dialysis patient. She came in because they were saying she had altered mental status. Her mentation had changed. And
altered mental status. Okay.
Yeah. And that was the clue. So they ended up doing a CT on her head. And they found the middle cranial fossa subdural hematoma. And it revealed that there was actually quite a large one. And had they said had she not come in when she did, she would not have probably survived. This was, I think it was like 6 to 7 millimeters of an acute subdural hematoma.
Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
and they never stop coming in.
No, it never stops. It seems to be that the patients that are coming in are they're at home for quite some time. Some of them, like I told you, the 29-year-old should not have even been at our. We shouldn't even be seeing them. But others were supposed to be followed by their primary care physicians, outpatients, following up with them. I think part of the problem is the primary care physicians' offices are blowing them off because they are overloaded with cases as well, and people are not, you know, people aren't following up with the doctors enough. So what happens is they're getting the signs possibly early enough, but they're not acting on it because you can't get into the doctor's office. You call them up and they're like, we'll see you in 3 weeks from now. So, of course, you leave them in this situation and then 3 weeks later, before they even get to the doctor, before they ever see a doctor, they're already having a massive stroke and now they're in the hospital. And they're in the hospital for weeks at a time.
Really?
All of these people have been in ICU for a number of weeks, then they'll transfer to another unit. If it's a heart issue, they'll go to a cardiac telemetry floor. If it's a stroke patient, they're going to a neural telemetry floor, and they're getting monitored because, interestingly enough, even the stroke patients are having arrhythmias too, so they have to be monitored on a cardiac monitor 24/7. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is frightful.
Well,
what I'm hearing.
I mean, is the medical staff catching on as to what what's driving all of this new illness?
The nursing staff that I've been working with at this hospital are phenomenal. They actually, well, first of all, I should say a couple of things. Some of them came from Florida. Now, Florida didn't mandate, if you recall.
Yeah.
They didn't mandate the healthcare.
Right.
The other piece of this is interesting is, we were expecting that the nurses would end up coming from the Philippines or from, somewhere else. But as it turns out, they ended up coming. They have a lot of nurses from Haiti in this hospital. And it's so, but again, in answer to your question, yeah, they are clued in. They are very clued in. And that's the thing.
I said,
where are all the staff nurses? Well, all the staff nurses got shot up.
They're gone. They're fighting.
Who knows?
Many of them are fighting all kinds of issues, even one issue. Everyone who's taken those shots, I don't know. How much transmission of the awareness of why these patients are in there is being actually verbally told to the patients or their families? Do you tell the families, this is probably from the injections that your loved one here has gotten, the four shots or the three shots or whatever shots? Do you ever tell them that?
Yeah, but the thing is I can't go in with guns blazing because some of them will get their backs up because they think some of them actually support the whole thing. But for the families who have questions and are open-minded and have already, I feel them out to see what they say. And I'll find out, have they done a little bit of research? And if they're starting to think that the vaccines had some play in it, and then I will always tell them that, there's probably a good odds that the vaccine is the reason why your loved one is here now. But you won't hear it from a physician. You'll not hear it. The physicians won't tell you.
Well, many of them are shot up.
Well, interesting. The physicians the hospital can provide as many physicians as they need, but they can't seem to be able to provide the nurses. The question is what happened to the staff nurses? And in an interesting story, while I was not on the radio for a few months, we had the last hospital I worked at, we had a nurse who was found dead in her car. She had seen her daughter, and she left her daughter's house, and I worked with this nurse, so I knew her, and a bunch of my friends knew her, and she left her daughter's house, and then she was reported missing, and 2 days later she was found dead in her car. She was one of those nurses who had been vaccinated.
Oh, wow. Tragic.
Sorry. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, let's go back to, we just have a few minutes left, Ann, just in the next 60 or 90 seconds, to the oncology aspect. What kinds of cancers are you seeing there? Anything in particular, or is it all over the body?
There's a lot of similarities. There's the brain tumors that we find usually working them up for something else. There's pancreatic cancers, and then what you think is pulmonary embolus in the lungs initially turns out to be a tumor, and then the kidneys. So those are the four major organs that are actually getting attacked.
Wow. All right, last question. Are you admitting many people with confirmed and diagnosed COVID viral infections now? Is the virus showing up, a variant thereof? Is the virus showing up?
No, COVID is like COVID came and went. COVID came and went. They do the testing. Most people don't even. It doesn't even register.
The point is, you're not treating people for COVID at all.
You're treating people
for vax injuries.
Yeah, there's no COVID. I haven't had any COVID cases. I mean, zero. There's no COVID cases.
Wow. Well, there you go.
There's none. There's none currently in the intensive care unit. Zero.
There you go.
Erica, anything else here?
Well, that's just correlating with what I've been reading in some of these practitioners' support groups. The cancers are exploding. The usual things that have been there all along, the abnormal clotting, the heart issues. But it's tragic to see this now exceptionally young people.
Well, it's like a power lawnmower. It's just going through. These vax injuries are just wiping out.
You're not in
children.
Would you be seeing any pediatric cases on your unit, or is that a separate?
No, it's a separate. They usually go. There's a separate unit for the kids and the neonates. It's even a separate hospital actually for them.
Okay.
They're part of the same building or the same ownership umbrella, but they're in separate hospitals. So I wouldn't see any of the children at all.
Okay.
These are all pretty much adult patients that I'm seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
I know. All right, Ann, we have to go. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
More than that. Thank you for being who you are. You are no doubt an inspiration to an awful lot of other professionals, nurses, and so forth. Your dedication is not only saving lives, but it's inspiring lives. And you take care of yourself. Very few of you out there. You're amazing.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Erica. Thank you, Jeff. And I really do appreciate the time talking to you guys. And get the word out because I don't know what to do anymore. But I went into this profession to save people, and I don't think we're not saving anybody now. We're just trying to give them a little longer of a life. But they're very sick
anybody.
Now.
How sad! How sad! Wow! All right. Well, Ann, let's. Get you back whenever you feel ready. We're here.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, hang in there. Right. Good job.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Good night, Ann. You too.
Well, I don't know how you even begin to thank somebody like that. I made a little shot.
No, that's incredible. You know, that really...
This is like Superwoman. This is just, I'm sure that a lot of hospitals don't have a nurse Anne on staff. And I know people well enough that I would suggest that she is truly inspirational to some of her younger colleagues who are just getting involved with it. This is really a scene. It's going
well
down.
I think you know, the nurses that have hung in there, mm-hmm. you know, from the beginning are really these are your real heroes now.
Not many left. The staff nurses are gone, as she said. So this is,
I mean, they are weathering
together.
A lot of hardship, right. to keep doing what they're doing.
They're actually creating staff with travel nurses. Unreal. They can't keep doing this. You're going to run out of travel nurses. Who wants to be away from home for 90 days? I mean, the money's good, but that's a tough call. And then we have the issue of shedding, and we have just the emotional load of carrying that kind of a profession is not...